You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're getting an update now on the 51-year-old employee of Molson Coors Brewing who opened fire on his coworkers Wednesday, killing five men before he turned the gun on himself. Milwaukee Chief of Police Alfonso Morales was speaking at a news conference yesterday about what is known and unknown about the suspect.
He was a current employee of Molson Coors at the time of this incident. Reasons for this is still under investigation of what transpired, and we don't have that for you.
Let's get an update now on what we do know with our WPR reporter, Corrine Hess, in Milwaukee. Corey, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Kate.
So you were at the press briefing yesterday with the Milwaukee Police Department. What did they share about the situation?
Well, they finally did release the name, which, as you said, is Anthony Farrell, and they gave the names of the victims. And these people were powerhouse operators, machinists, electricians. They ranged in age from 33 to 61 years old. You know, they were all obviously loved by their families. They were fathers, husbands, you know, beloved in the community.
So Farrell was 51. He'd worked as an electrician for more than 20 years. What do we know about his life?
Well, you know, I spent a lot of the day in his neighborhood, and I was at his house. Police surrounded his house for the day. They had tape up. But I talked to his neighbors, and his neighbors were really shocked by this. They liked him a lot. They said that he was really helpful. He lived in the house for about 15 years with his wife and young daughter. They had this system in the neighborhood where whoever woke up first shoveled the sidewalk for everyone. Anthony Farrell usually got up first and did the shoveling. It's a small, kind of close-knit neighborhood, modest homes. A lot of elderly people live there. And he helped people. He took one man to doctor's appointments when he needed help. And like I said, people were really sad and shocked by this.
What have police learned about what happened inside that building on Wednesday?
You know, whatever they've learned, they're not sharing at this point. I think that information will be coming out in coming days and weeks.
So law enforcement, in terms of understanding a motive, we just don't have one yet.
No, we don't. We don't have any type of motive at this point.
We heard yesterday from Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett reflecting on the role Molson Coors plays in the community. Let's listen.
Miller and Molson Coors are a very important part of this community. For over a century and a half, they've been part of the fabric of this community. And they've been there for us, and it's now time for us to be there for them as well.
So what was Chief Morales and Mayor Barrett's message to the community?
I think yesterday's message was really to give the victims' families some space and some time to grieve, and also just, again, stating the importance of this company in the community. I mean, like the mayor said, it's been around for more than 150 years. This is really a legacy company in both Milwaukee and the state. For more than 100 years, it's been Miller Coors. Now it's Molson Coors Beverage Company, but that hadn't changed the importance. Last night, there was a local church that held a vigil, and everybody's just kind of in a mourning period right now.
Talking with Corrine Hess, she is WPR's reporter based in Milwaukee, and she's been covering the aftermath of the mass shooting that took place Wednesday at Molson Coors Brewery Complex. Corey, the leadership there at the brewery, they said that they would remain closed for a period of time. Let's listen to CEO Gavin Hattersley yesterday.
Now, I've spent the day speaking with the families of the victims and meeting with our employees here in Milwaukee because they are our single and number one priority at the moment.
What did you find out from the leadership there at the company?
I haven't talked to leadership, but as you can hear, they are also, you know, in a state of shock. The leaders were in Houston for a conference. They all flew back. And they're also trying to figure out a motive and what's been going on there. I believe they're going to be part of the investigation to find out what was going through Anthony Farrell's mind when this happened.
Have you heard anything from employees there since Wednesday?
We did speak to an employee. Employees gathered at a local restaurant yesterday, and she was saying that, you know, when they got the email at 2 o'clock from an alert system saying that there was an active shooter, they all they were scared. Of course, they were on lockdown for 3 hours. This woman that we talked to was on the north side of campus. The shooting was on the south side. So she said that some employees kind of hid. She actually went back to work for a little while because she knew the proximity and she felt safe. But she did say that, you know, everybody has kind of a different process of grieving and sort of post-traumatic stress. She said that some of her coworkers actually tried to go back to work on Thursday but were turned away. So I think everybody's sort of processing this differently.
Do the workers you talked to there at the restaurant, do they have a clear communication line to what the company will do next? Do they understand what the next steps are?
I think they're all just waiting to go back to work at this point.
What does the law enforcement response to this kind of event look like? Has it been coordinated? What have you seen there?
You know, law enforcement is keeping us up to date as much as they can. And the agencies, there's been many agencies involved.
What is the conversation around Milwaukee? You're in the thick of the city. You've been covering this. Is there anything that we can glean about how Milwaukee is doing right now?
I would say that the whole city seems to be really rallying around Miller Coors, Molson Coors, and the victims. Like I said, the church in suburban Milwaukee held a vigil last night. And, you know, there's been T-shirts made by another local company that I hear are going to be donated to the workers. Everybody is just kind of in a mode of wanting to do what they can to help. And I feel like the city's really rallying around Molson Coors and each other at this point.
So what is still unknown about what happened on Wednesday? What are we still trying to find out?
I think there's a lot of unknowns. Mainly, people are trying to figure out what made Anthony Farrell go from this seemingly really nice neighbor, family man, somebody who had spent 20 years of his life working as an electrician, to somebody who could kill 5 of his coworkers and then himself.
Well, Corey, thank you so much for joining us and for covering this.
Thank you for having me.
Corinne Hess is Wisconsin Public Radio's reporter. She is based in Milwaukee. You can learn more about this event, the events of Wednesday, on our website at WPR.org. Coming up, we learn about how African Americans set down roots in Beloit and the role the city played in the Great Migration. That's coming up in just a moment. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network.
If you're just joining us, it's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We will be talking about organic farming in Wisconsin, specifically in our dairy herds, with a fifth-generation farmer. Is your farm organic? What do you produce? How long have you been farming, and how is your business doing? Share your challenges, your situation in the certified organic industry. Right now, we're at 800-642-1234. But first, let's touch down in Beloit. The city's roots extend much farther into the Deep South, and a local researcher is working to spread the stories of some of the first African Americans to move to Beloit during the Great Migration. Linda Fair is an academic advisor at Black Hawk Technical College in Janesville, and she talked with WPR host Keely Baltina about her research. Help us understand, when we start to see African Americans migrating to Beloit, what's driving that migration?
What drove the migration mainly was African-Americans migrating from the South, and what one of the main reasons was a company here in Beloit, which is still there, Fairbanks and Morris, were looking for extra help right during the time of the war. Their production level was high, and their bodies of employees were low, so they sought out ways that they can increase their workforce, and a gentleman that worked there as a custodian felt he had an in connection with some people from the South, because that's where his family was from, and they were looking, you know, for more success, more ways to be prosperous, and more adventures. So that's how he recruited for them to come up here and, you know, bring their families up.
What did Fairbanks, Morse and Company make during the war?
They are a Fairbanks Morse Company, and they still are. They were doing some of the naval engines and industrial equipment of that nature.
The company realized, hey, this is an untapped resource for workers. If we can get them up here, we can do what we do better. Faster.
Exactly. More. Yes, exactly. And again, at this time, they were thinking of ways, too, that they can become successful and do more, you know, want to bring their families up to a different type of environment where they might not experience as much racial tension, and again, be able to work and provide for their families and send back for some of their other family members.
But is that what happened when these families thought maybe we can escape some of the bad things of our lives here in the South? Did it change for them when they came to Wisconsin?
Yes and no. To the degree they were able to make money, but they still faced some different racial tension. They found out soon that just because Wisconsin was in the North, all the people that lived here were not as accepting of integrating communities and seeing them in the workforce. They still felt a little segregated into themselves. And even though they were in the bigger community, they had their own community within a community, if you know what I mean. That's when Fairbanks Morse helped incorporate places for them to live, helped incorporate places for them to worship and fellowship, because they used the church as a social center, and then they were able to, they built what was called Edgewater YMCA and brought up someone from the South to be the superintendent of that location, just so they did feel that they had some type of outlet, but nevertheless, they still felt segregated.
What's the time frame we're talking about here?
Basically, the Great Migration was from around 1915 up until about 1970.
And what was it like in Beloit for that first wave of African Americans who came up? You know, you said the company really helped, but what did they experience when they got here?
They found themselves having not enough space to live. Again, like I mentioned earlier, with a places to worship, because they were, you know, heavy into their faith, and just finding jobs for other family members. So that was some of the stuff that they faced, too, once they got here.
And what then was their standard of living when they first came to Wisconsin? Did it differ dramatically from their experiences in the South?
I would would say probably a combination. It was a little bit of the same. Again, like I mentioned, they were found themselves segregated, staying in one certain area. Fairbanks was nice enough to build and accommodate them. They created some row houses, which are still in existence in Beloit, called the Fairbanks Flats, and that's where the majority of them stayed. And so they were able to really build a community, like I said, within a community, and they majority of the workers stayed there. So now families who aren't related by blood, but now they are becoming one big family, and they're working together, they're eating together and socializing and just hanging with each other, just to kind of for that comfort and protection.
Linda Fair is an academic advisor at Blackhawk Technical College in Janesville, and we're talking about her research into the early history of African Americans in Beloit, Wisconsin. And Linda, this is part of your own family story.
Yes, it is. My family, my mom was part of the Great Migration. My grandfather came up, him and his brothers, to work in one of the other local foundries around Beloit, which was known then as Iron Works, and then it changed the name to Beloit Corporation. So he came up, and he worked there for close to 50 years, and they came in the mid-1930s. Again, just taking a chance, word traveled that there's room for growth and opportunity in this city. So they just took a chance and came up, and then his brothers came also, and they all lived under one roof. My mom and her siblings, along with which would have been their aunts and uncles, they all just stayed under one roof together.
And this is something
coming from Houston, Mississippi. Yes.
When you think about the stories that your family has told, does that seem to fit with the experiences that you've researched that other families had?
Yes, it does. Where my grandmother was a domestic in the home, she and like my aunts, they stayed and tend to the children, could clean and that type of housework around the house and home, while the guys and the gentlemen went out and worked in the foundries like Fairbanks Morris. I had an uncle there, and then also, like I said, Iron Works. So they were doing the work, the manual labor, while the women stayed home. And most of the people I've talked to, that's how it was. It was the gentlemen, the men going out into the workforce, actually working, and the ladies were home tending to the children and tending to meals and tending to the home.
This moment in history changed the makeup of the city of Beloit. It changed the racial proportions here. We saw a lot more African Americans coming to Beloit. When is it that they go from feeling like outsiders to people in the African community, like seeing an opportunity to be part of the community, to serve?
It was well into almost like the 40s and 50s after they finally started feeling like we can make our name here, we can be comfortable here, and they started opening up their own businesses, from barbershops to restaurants, even running hotels such as the Dewdrop Inn, things of that nature. They started feeling a little more empowered and taking a chance, and it was working for them at that time.
And what is the status then that we see today? Are these tensions the same, or is this a place where you hear from the African community that they feel is part theirs?
I hate to say it, at this time they still don't quite feel as much ownership for the community. Beloit has a 15% makeup of African Americans in their community at the time, and we still struggle, and I'm saying we because I'm an African American female, we still struggle with being recognized and able to move up in corporate worlds, still have to face like some prejudices and racism with different roles and jobs and sections of the city where we live. And it's almost like history repeating itself, that we're regressing some, although there are other opportunities where some African Americans are really shining and setting the stage for our younger generation to know how hard it was and to remove some of the barriers. So it's better, but there's room for improvement.
And how do we make sure that people know these stories so that the bad of history doesn't repeat itself?
Again, similar to what I do, it started 4 years ago with just doing Beloit Black History Moments through my Facebook page just as a personal gift that I thought I should do for our younger people, because I was always around my mom, them, and other people, and listening and just like a sponge absorbing all of the information. So I feel that I can't just hold on to this information. I need to spread the word, and times have changed. Social media is that vehicle now where you could get the information out, and that's one of the things that I've, you know, taken on, just really trying to spread the word, and if nothing else, to encourage and empower our younger generation that you can do and become whatever you want. Things are different, but you have a little bit of the same, but you can still go forward and try. If they made it through some of these hardships, you should be able to do what you want to do and be it whatever you can be at this time.
Linda, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
And that was Linda Fair with Black Hawk Technical College talking with WPR host Keely Boltina about the early history of African Americans in Beloit. You can find a write-up of a talk Linda gave and a video of the talk itself. That's at wiscontext.org. Coming up, California is the only state with more organic farms than Wisconsin, and we lead the nation in the number of certified organic dairies. Did your farm transition to organic? Why did you decide to make the change? Was it worth it? Are you an organic processor in Wisconsin? What does it take to get organic milk to consumers? Phone lines are open right now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's talk about the state of organic farming from your vantage point. It's coming up right after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Organic Farming Conference is underway in La Crosse. It's put on by the Midwest Organic and Sustainable Education Service. It attracts thousands of people with dozens of workshops. We're checking in on the state of organic farming here in Wisconsin. Is your farm organic? What do you produce? How long have you been in business, and how is production? What questions do you have about running an organic operation? We're at 800-642-1234. Adam Seibel is a fifth-generation farmer in Bloomer. He co-owns a certified organic dairy with 140 cows on about 1,200 acres. Adam, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thank you.
So what brought you into organic farming? How did you get into this business?
That was something that my parents had transitioned the farm to almost 20 years ago. So when I came to the farm, it was a organic farm to start with. So that's really what I grew up knowing. I really don't know any other way. But my parents did it looking for a little better way of farming, a little bit better on the profitability side and the health aspect.
So you transitioned your family farm in the 90s. What have you learned since then over the decades about what it takes to be an organic farmer?
We've gone through lots of different trials with the cows and the crops, and the big thing is every year is different. There's not going to be one silver bullet that works every year, so we just don't put all of our eggs in one basket when it comes to the crops or the cows or anything in general.
Well, let's start with the cows first. You have some robotic milkers, is that right?
Yes, we do. We installed them 8.5 years ago now.
How have they operated for you?
They were a struggle at first. It was a learning experience mainly, learning how to handle and manage cows using the robotics and the technology that came along with it. Being in it as long as we are now, it was one of the best investments we've really made, allowed for a lot more flexibility in our day-to-day schedules, and just a much easier or healthier way of milking the cows, I should say.
Yeah, and so how do you balance out trying to focus on the organic crops and also trying to make sure you keep up with this certified organic dairy with 140 cows? There's probably a lot to think about almost in two different business models.
Yeah, there is. that's why we have a great group of employees that help us out. I also work closely with my dad and my brother, and we all kind of divvy up our jobs, and we all work together to kind of execute the tasks that are needed to be done that day. You know, we definitely couldn't do it without a good group of guys to achieve the goals for the day. That's the big key there.
So as you look at technology for your planting and cropland, what are you using there? What are you using on your crops?
So we've implemented some precision planting technologies. So we can make sure that we're planting the corn in the correct position at the correct depth and at the correct time. We've also experimented with all sorts of different tillage practices and crop rotations, and we do a lot of cover cropping. So there's just a really big, diverse group of things that we do.
And when you're with tillage, you're rotating the soil. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah, we have to do tillage to control weeds.
And, you know, controlling weeds is a big issue among organic farmers, because you have to figure out, you know, what can you use on crops and what can't you use, and that has to be really specific. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, there's certain herbicides that we can spray. We personally do not use any sort of organic herbicide. We don't feel the need to. As long as you have a good diverse crop rotation with good cover crops, for the most part, we can control a lot of our weeds. We're using alfalfa strategically to give the weed cycle a break, especially on our row crops.
And what types of row crops do you plant?
So we raise corn, soybeans. We're looking at possibly doing kidney beans. And we'll do a lot of small grains, oats, winter rye. We've experimented with field peas, and we've done wheat once or twice, but we haven't successfully been able to do that one.
Kidney beans, what attracts you there? What are you seeing there in that market?
Well, the price is very good. We have not planted this yet. This is something we're looking into possibly doing this year. I hear they're a pain in the butt to harvest, but it's a very short growing crop. So you plant it beginning in June, and it's typically harvested around the beginning of September. So you have a very short window where your weeds hopefully will not mature. So it's something where you can kind of use it as a weed management tool as well.
So as you plan out your crops and what you're going to plant and when, do you have to look at market forces as well and what the organic industry is wanting?
We do to a certain extent. We do take that into consideration, because, you know, the bottom line is we have to be able to cash flow and pay our bills, so we want to plant the most profitable crops. But also we look long term. We have to look at what sort of crop rotation is going to make the organic system sustainable. That is one big difference in the conventional mindset versus the organic mindset, is we're always looking long term. What is the effects of this crop being planted 5 years from now? Whether it's just soil diversity, getting different bacteria in the soil, versus, you know, if you're doing a constant corn-on-corn rotation, you don't have a lot of diversity in the soil.
We're talking with Adam Seibel. He's a fifth-generation farmer of Cones, a certified organic dairy farm, also with row crops there. He has 140 cows. You can join in the conversation. What are your thoughts on state policies regarding organic and sustainable production? Is there enough being done to help family farms survive in Wisconsin? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Adam, Wisconsin, as you know, leads the nation in farm bankruptcies. More than 800 dairy farms closed last year. Are organic farmers up against the same obstacles, the same challenges as farmers who don't go organic on their farms?
Yeah, we are. Recently, the milk market has become flooded with milk. So we've had to really change our strategies as far as looking at our cost of production a lot closer, trying to get that as low as possible. With feed costs as high as they are, it becomes very difficult. A lot of it has to do with the regulations as well. They're not being enforced as well as I would like to see them.
What do you mean by that?
Pasturing rules. You have to graze a certain amount of time on pasture, and if you're an extremely large herd, it becomes very difficult. So if you're not enforcing these rules on the national level, it becomes very easy for large farms to come in and flood this market. And that's what's happened over the last 3 to 4 years.
You're talking about CAFOs, these large capacity farms. Do you see that they have an impact on your bottom line?
Yeah, they do. I mean, our pay price went from the mid-30s down to the low 20s in a matter of, well, 14 months. So being able to adjust your budget with that kind of cash deficit in that short amount of time is very, very difficult. Thankfully, we've had a good lending source, and we've been able to, or they've been willing to work with us on it because they know the struggles that we're going through.
Looking at feed costs here for a moment, do they fluctuate much in the market?
That is the one strong point in the organic market right now is grain prices. They typically are pretty stable. There's not a whole lot of fluctuation in price. I guess the milk market kind of goes that way too. It's stable. It's not good, but it's stable. So the grain prices are relatively stable. They tend to increase slightly maybe throughout the summer and then fall back around harvest time and then early winter. Is kind of the trend.
Well, let's take a call now. Owen is joining us from Waiwega. Hi, Owen.
Yeah, hi, good morning. Thanks for taking the call. Yeah, so I've been farming in Wisconsin since 2013. Lisa and I looked at two organic farms that were shipping to Organic Valley. One was shipping 6 months before, and the other one hadn't shipped for a few years. In both instances, these were smaller herds, smaller capacity farms, and we were turned down for milk market because, you know, like he had been saying, there's too much milk on the market right now. My biggest concern is, you know, the co-op can control who's coming in and who's producing for them. And it seems to me like they like to have these larger herds like the ones out in Texas and Missouri that are milking 10 and 20,000 cows on pasture, supposedly, which is almost inconceivable because you can't run cows back into milk.
Well, Owen, I want to pause right there and look at getting the milk to processors. Adam, what about this piece, trying to get your milk to the processor?
I mean, I agree with this gentleman. It is more cost effective to ship the milk from a large farm to the processor. However, that's not what the consumer is looking for. They're not looking for these mega farms to be shipping this kind of milk. So from a cost production standpoint, I see that it is more cost effective to be able to ship tanker loads of milk from one farm directly to the creamery.
We're talking about the business of organic farms with Adam Seibel, who co-owns an organic dairy in western Wisconsin. You can join in this conversation. Are you a farmer who has transitioned to organic? Why did you decide to make the change? How many years ago? Was it recent? And is it worth it? Are you going to the organic farming conference in La Crosse that's underway? What do you want to learn? Join in the conversation on organic farming, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. We'll get back to this conversation in just a moment with Adam Seibel. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. Talking about the business of certified organic farming here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The state Senate is expected to take up farm relief bills when it meets next month, and the package came after Governor Evers called a special session to help the state's farmers and rural communities.
Wisconsin leads the nation in family farm bankruptcies. So how is your organic farm operation doing? What do you think about state policies regarding organic and sustainable production? Is there enough being done to help family farms, specifically organic ones? Join in 800-642-1234. Adam Seibel stays with us. He runs a certified organic dairy farm, does row crops as well in Bloomer. Let's take a call now. Cindy is here from Milwaukee this morning. Hi, Cindy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I want to buy organic milk. Where does your milk go after it leaves your farm?
So our milk is shipped to Westby Creamery, which is right in Westby. However, none of our milk is actually made or left into fluid milk. It all goes into cheese. So if you're looking for a good source of milk that is raised locally, your best bet is to buy Organic Valley. They seem to be the number one processor in this area of organic milk.
Cindy, thank you for the call. In November last year, Adam, Dean Foods, the largest dairy producer, filed for bankruptcy, and the company did work closely with Wisconsin-based Organic Valley, which has said it's unaffected by the bankruptcy. How important is it to have a reliable organic distributor that's based near your farm?
Well, that allows us to do a lot of efficiencies when it comes to the sale of our milk. We don't have to haul it all across the country like other places may have to get it here into the Midwest where a lot of the organic processors are. So having it close is very beneficial from that standpoint. It's also nice to have that market right in this area. It's kind of been the footprint of the country for organic, and that really represents this area very well.
Let's bring in Pat now in Watertown. Hi, Pat.
Hello.
What's on your mind about organic? You're a dairy farmer.
I am. I'm a dairy farmer out by Watertown. We milk about 100 cows. And I just wanted to call in and just chime into the conversation slightly in that there's nothing absolutely at all wrong with organic, but I am a conventional farmer. I use antibiotics on my animals when they get sick. And then, you know, hold the milk and hold the meat for appropriate times, and just kind of wanted to remind folks out there that there's nothing wrong with organic, and there's nothing wrong with regular milk. Every gallon of milk that you see on the store shelf and every block of cheese is antibiotic free. There's no antibiotics that make it from us. You know, here at the farm, every load of milk is tested before it ever, you know, enters the plant.
Pat, thank you for bringing that point, your perspective from conventional practices. Adam, what happens when your cows get sick?
So we do have natural remedies that we can try to use. They're not 100% effective all the time, but one thing we look at on our farm a lot is soil health. So what we believe in is we work with everything from the ground up. So when we have healthy soils, we have healthy feed, and that healthy feed and nutritious feed is fed to our cattle. We work very closely with the nutritionists to get a well-balanced ration, and to be honest, we seldomly have sick animals.
So it's really a cycle that if you start from the ground up that and everything is done appropriately, you can really keep your dairy cattle healthy.
Yeah, that is true.
Let's bring in Scott now in Middleton. Hi, Scott.
Hello, how are you?
Good.
My question is simple. If I'm driving through rural Wisconsin, how do I tell the difference between an organic cow and a non-organic cow?
You can't. They look identical. You will not know the difference. A lot of times you can't even tell the difference in an organic crop versus a conventional crop. All you're going to see in the field from that standpoint would be a sign that says this field is certified organic or toxic spray prohibited.
Scott, thanks for that question. Adam, how difficult is it to get certified organic?
It's really not that difficult of a process. Transitioning the land is a three-year process, so you have to, for three consecutive years, not use any prohibited substances, whether it's a a spray, a fertilizer, or whatever it might be. But you cannot use any prohibited substances for 3 years, and then your land becomes certified organic. And then after that process, you feed that feed to your cattle for 1 year, and then your cattle will become organic as well. If you want to streamline that process, you could purchase organic feed, and your cattle could become organic in 1 year.
Okay, so it can either be a multi-year process if you buy the feed, or you're looking a single-year process if you buy the feed, but multi-year if you are trying to do it from the grassroots from your own farm.
Yes, that is correct.
Well, let's bring in Jim now in Cedarburg. Jim, hi. Oh, are you there, Jim? Nope, he's not there. Well, Jim was wondering about legislation. We saw the state Senate plans to take up a package of farm bills that recently passed the assembly. You know, one provides $5 million to promote dairy exports. Another will provide $600,000 in grants to dairy plants. What do you see out of this farm relief package, Adam?
I guess I don't focus too much on the farm relief packages because they don't really focus on the organic side at all. It's all based on the conventional markets, the conventional demand and supply. So I know very little about what is going on with the conventional supply and demand market, and I seldomly pay that close attention to it, so I couldn't give it a good answer on that.
One of the bills, of the seven bills, is looks specifically at a tax reimbursement for a tax credit for health care. Where do you get your health care, if I may ask, and other types of things that you need for your business and types of insurance and things like that?
So we work with a Christian health sharing plan. And it's been very reasonably priced. It's something that we just started here this past year. My wife became a stay-at-home mom who works as a health nutritional coach right now. And so prior to that, we were getting health insurance through her work. But now we are doing it through this Christian Health. And it seems to be a very good company. We haven't had to use them a whole lot yet. But it's very reasonably priced. And that's what we're looking at with that.
Talking with Adam Seibel, co-owns a certified organic dairy in Western Wisconsin. You can join in 800-642-1234. So, Adam, yesterday the Organic Farming Conference kicked off in La Crosse. It's put on by the Midwest Organic and Sustainable Education Service, runs through tomorrow. You're headed there after our conversation. How does this event support organic farmers?
This really just gives organic farmers a chance to get together and talk and also sit down and learn all new practices that might be going on throughout the country, give you different ideas to go back to the farm and get excited again about what you could maybe do this year or things you could change. And if you're looking at certain little health aspects, they have a wider range of classes and seminars that you can attend to really learn whatever you want that would pertain to organic farming or organic health.
I'd imagine you talk with other organic farmers there and you exchange ideas.
Yeah, we do. That's probably the best part about this is just sitting down at lunch or in between classes and meeting new farmers and talking to them about what they're doing in their business. And it really does help a lot because every farm is really different and not one thing works on another farm. So when you sit down and you start bringing these little ideas back to your farm, some may work, some don't, and that's just the joy of farming.
Well, Adam, thank you for joining us and sharing your joy of farming.
Thank you.
Adam Seibel is a fifth-generation farmer who lives in Western Wisconsin, and he co-owns a certified organic dairy with 140 cows. Last year, he and his wife, Chrissy, were named the Wisconsin Outstanding Young Farmers of the Year. Coming up on Wisconsin Weekend, we explore fat tire biking trails straight across the state and why these bikes are becoming more popular. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.